Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Martin Luther King Jr. writes to John F. Kennedy on September 15, 1963, the day of the Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama. Dear Mr. President, I shudder to think what our nation has become when Sunday school children and their teachers are killed in church by racist bombs. Four young girls dressing for church choir that Sunday morning have been murdered. Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Carol Denise McNair. Dynamite stacked on the back wall of their church destroyed the building, killing the four girls and injuring others. The savage bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church this morning is another clear indication of the moral degradation of the state of Alabama and Governor George Wallace. Mr. President, you must call for legislation. King is preparing to make the dreadful journey to Birmingham to plead with the community there to somehow remain nonviolent in the face of senseless slaughter. But it would be more than 10 years in 1977, before the first of the killers would be charged and found guilty on one count of murder. 20 years after, the FBI reopened the case and indicted two other men. A fourth had died in the interceding 30 years. All four of these men were members of the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK. This gruesome act galvanized public opinion in favor of the legislation King sought to pass. A year later, on July 2, 1964, the Civil Rights Act was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson. Many today forget the tragedy and sacrifice that propelled that legislation forward. The KKK has a long and hideous legacy of unpunished crimes, so many on full display for a nation and a world appalled.
Hi, everyone. This is American History Hit. Greetings. Welcome. I'm Don Wildman. When any group or business can be identified by their abbreviation, say AAA or BMX or FIFA, it implies that their purpose in our world has become so familiar, we only need a few letters for reference. Sad, then, to consider that over the course of almost 160 years since the Civil War, the KKK has become one of those abbreviations we know so well, too well, seared into our memory banks by force of ill will. The symbols of the burning cross, the pointed head sheet costumes, the cryptic iconography, all of it. Intentional branding designed to intimidate, frighten, and control, and of course, encourage like-minded people to join them in the glorious name of white supremacy. KKK, designed to be remembered, and it worked. We may not fear the Ku Klux Klan in America as we once did, but it still creeps us out, silly as those costumes were. Like a cancer in and out of remission, the KKK has faded and reemerged, each time adopting new poses and positions to pursue its militant agenda of terror. So it's vital that we understand its history, its origins and operation, and the continuing influence it still has on our society. And we'll do this today in the company of Christopher Alafet, Associate Professor of U.S. History at the University of Exeter in England, author of The Ku Klux Klan, An American History, first published in 2023 by the History Press. Hello, sir. Hi, Chris.
Hello. How are you, John?
I'm good. You're over there in England, speaking from a whole new other perspective.
Yes.
Christopher, I know I speak for most listeners when I say, ugh, the KKK, a visceral repulsion upon me. And yet it is important history that opens a gate to understanding the institutional racism of our past and the ongoing attempt to reclaim it. Quite a tale. What draws a good Englishman to this strange subject?
Well, I'm the son of an immigrant, and I started off my PhD after having spent 20 years as a hill farmer on Dartmoor. I started off my PhD looking at anti-immigration sentiment in the Pacific Northwest, and the Klan played a big role in that. When I started teaching at Exeter, I was asked to do a third-year course, and I thought, well, the Klan would be quite an interesting course. So for about 25 years, I've been studying it fairly consistently.
Chris, tell me about the first origins of this. It's kind of a fraternal organization, really not anything that we're used to thinking of the KKK as, right? This is right after the Civil War.
Well, if you think about the Civil War and the end of the Civil War, I mean, civil wars are not like wars between nation states. You can't really have a treaty. It's all or nothing. It's defeat or victory. And the result of that is that the South is thrown into a very, very precarious situation. It's not just defeated, it's destroyed. And many people, particularly the veterans of the Civil War, of which the original six of the Klan were veterans, many of those people were disaffected with the idea that not only had they lost, but the reason for that loss, which they saw as being the now freed, enslaved people of the South, the reason is that they are just about to be given major powers, particularly with the 14th Amendment and then with the 15th Amendment as well, obviously with the 13th. But that's really a situation. It's a very volatile situation. In many ways, it's peculiar that the Civil War didn't go directly into guerrilla warfare. There was talk of that. Jefferson Davis certainly wanted that. We're looking at a situation that is extremely volatile, and at any point, it could just flash up.
Chris, I mentioned the shapeshifter quality of this organization, its membership peaking and falling several times in its history. It's really kind of a three-part story. Can you break it down into those phases?
Yes, there's three really visible phases, but it doesn't die out in between. There are incidences in between, not particularly major and not actually particularly violent, really. But the three identifiable periods are the Reconstruction period from 1865 to 1877 in the Deep South, the 1920s, which somehow seems a bit of an anomaly with the other two periods that are really quite memorable. And the third one is the Civil Rights era, basically from 1954 through until almost 1970, I suppose, really.
In order to understand the birth of the KKK in its first iteration, you really have to see it against the backdrop of Reconstruction. What was it about that era, eventually the amendments that are made to the Constitution, that energized this small little group of guys into something much bigger and much more dangerous?
The Klan starts in Reconstruction, 1865 Christmas. And it continues pretty well through until the end of the Reconstruction period, which is generally settled on as about 1877. It then dies back, and even though there are a couple of small flashpoints where it emerges again, it's pretty well dormant until 1915. And then in 1915, it emerges, but it's not terribly powerful until the 1920s. And when it goes into the 1920s, it's got a membership in the millions. It dies out at the end of the 1920s, really for a variety of reasons, but mainly scandal. And then it reemerges in the Civil Rights era. And in the Civil Rights era, it starts pretty much at the very start of the civil, what we would consider to be the Civil Rights era in 1954, and then runs pretty well constantly until 1970. Beyond that, it does have a presence, and particularly in the 1970s and 1980s, through almost until today. But it dies out pretty quickly after the 1960s because it is so disastrously badly represented in the press. As I said, the South is in a very precarious situation. The 14th Amendment is really the stumbling block because what happens is that most of the former Confederate states are excluded from rejoining the Union until they have actually accepted the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment totally upends the entirety of Southern society. You know, Southern society is built on a caste system, and at the very bottom of that caste system, you have the slaves. So the black population, for them to be given the vote by the 14th Amendment, for them to become politically active, is absolutely terrifying. There is an insurgency against this, and the Klan is the perfect vehicle for that in many ways.
The very beginnings of the Ku Klux Klan are necessary to understand, but it's a completely different idea than what it eventually becomes. This is really a small group of friends, really, in Tennessee who create a kind of fraternal organization. Where's the name come from?
Yes, it's six Confederate veterans, varying in age from, I think, early 20s to early 30s. But these are people who have been fighting all the way through. They've been right in the thick of it. And they come home to their hometown of Pulaski, Tennessee, and there's nothing to do. So what do? They meet up every now and then. And around about Christmas 1865, which is when we think it is, we're not certain of this, they have a meeting where they decide, according to their own version of this, they decide that they're going to found a fraternity. The name is really interesting because when they started, they put all sorts of names forward, one of which was the Thespians, which I always think is rather interesting if we'd had a terrorist group called the Thespians. But the name itself probably has a fairly prosaic origin, but there's lots of stories that go around about it. One of my favorite ones is that it's based on a chap called Clopton, who was the chief of a Native American tribe called the Ku Klux. And he was a real party animal. One time got so enthusiastic in his partying that he killed all his servants. The Lord of the Underworld watched this and came up from the underworld and kidnapped Clopton, his entire entourage, including his hunting horses and his hounds. And from then onwards, they terrorized the neighboring tribes. But this is interesting because it's a ghostly appearance. And this is the manifestation that we often see being used by the members of the Klan to terrorize the freedmen and to try and keep them in line. The real name comes from a much more prosaic background. Most of the Jolly Six had actually gone to university. They were educated men. And in one of the universities that they went to, the University of North Carolina, there was a fraternity called the Ku Klux Adelphon. And Ku Klux just means circle in Greek. And I think what they did was they just called themselves the Ku Klux Klan originally, and then it was Ku Klux Klan. So that's where the name originates from, we think. The trouble is that most of our accounts of the early Klan actually come from these so-called Jolly Six, the original founders. And of course, they have motives for interpreting it in certain ways.
Chris, tell me about the costumes. I mean, there's such deliberate craziness, really, when you see these things. You have a visceral response, which is mostly to roll your eyes and laugh.
Yeah, as Tarantino so well demonstrated, you know, that if you wear one of those hoods, the chances are that you won't be able to see. Having said that, as I said, the initial idea was to actually intimidate and terrify the freedmen. And it was regarded as dressing up in these costumes. But that's almost retrospective, because the real Klan costume emerges with the Birth of a Nation in 1915. Before that, if they wore any costume at all, it was just a disguise. And quite often, they just wear whatever they could. And if you look at early Klan costumes, they're more an aspect of carnival than anything else. They look ridiculous. They're kind of clown-like. All the more terrifying for that. But the hood as we know it nowadays emerged in the 1920s, and for a very practical reason. The Klan in the 1920s was a very, very lucrative organization. It was sold as a pyramid selling scheme. And one of the ways that they made more money to the original kind of your kleptoken, the joining fee, was to sell costumes. And if you're going to sell a costume, you don't want to sell a costume that people can make up a copy of it at home. So they made the pointed hood, because that's very difficult to replicate. You know, just an ordinary hood is quite easy, but this was difficult. So their factories designed this out of a stiffer material that was very difficult to replicate other than that.
How did they advertise themselves? How were they known, this small group? How does it spread?
They're quite well known from the very start, because one of the founding members is the editor of a local newspaper, and he's always carrying on about this. And I think just word of mouth, it spreads across the area. But they're very good at both using the fear that's associated with their name and also hiding. So it's that balancing act of trying to kind of, you know, get the sweet spot of that.
And, I mean, let's not be naive. This has been going on for hundreds of years. Slave patrols, all of this kind of thing is already a working system in the South and beyond even. The odd thing about this, as I understand, is that it's never really controlled from the center, is it? It's more of a kind of a whole bunch of chapters that just keep growing and proliferating.
Yes, which is both its strength and its weakness. The interesting thing about that is that almost every account that you read of the Ku Klux Klan says that its leader was Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a very successful guerrilla cavalry leader in the Confederate Army, Brigadier General. But I would dispute that he was the leader of the whole institution. He may have been a figurehead. But he, in 1869, he says, well, you know, we've achieved our purpose, we might as well disband. But actually, as W.B. Du Bois points out, the really violent Reconstruction period is actually in the early to mid-1870s. And even though the Klan may not exist, I mean, we don't know, even if they may not exist, what's interesting about it is that newspapers and other accounts refer to insurgency actions against the black population, against the Republican population, against the federal government occasionally. They refer to those as Ku Kluxing. So it becomes a generic name rather than the name of people dressing up in the well-known white hoods that we know.
We're talking about a paramilitary group, which is, you know, facing off against what they perceive as the imminent collapse of their society. The primary target is to suppress this new voter bloc, which are the freed black people in the South, as well as against the Republicans, these politicians who are rising, some of whom are black as well. All of this is really in the crosshairs of these people. It surprises me how quickly and severely the federal government reacts in the 1870s when Grant comes into power, right? There are anti-Klan laws that are passed and real measures are taken.
I'm not so sure about that. The general perception is that that's the normal way of looking at it. But the reality is that Grant comes into office having been the war leader that the South hate. You know, they hate him because he has been the instigator of a really brutal form of warfare. No longer is this, you know, cousin versus cousin, brother versus brother. This is, you know, really total war. And he leads that war effort. And the last thing that he wants to do is when he comes back into power, or when he gets into political power, the last thing he wants to be associated with is as a war leader. He wants to be seen as a political figure. And he shies away like mad from actually doing anything concrete with federal troops in the South. He's very, very reluctant. And even when he does actually do so in South Carolina in 1872, he doesn't really follow it through. The arrests are made, the Klansmen, many of them flee to North Carolina, but the situation is really resolved because the federal government once again backs down. And then, of course, you know, the other thing is that it's very successful because the interest shifts. It's no longer the South that's the point of interest. It's now the West. You know, we've got the Transcontinental Railway. People want to go West. They don't want to refight the Civil War by the mid-70s, in the North at least.
I'll be back with more American history after this short break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Chris, tell me about Grant taking power as president. It must have been quite something to have the former general become the president of the United States. How did the Klan react to this?
They call it redemption, and they've redeemed the southern states. They really have. Many of the former elites are back in power. Confederate generals are leading this so-called New South. It's a tragedy. It really is a tragedy.
So the irony, though, is that As a result of the success, after 1877, membership drops off. The Klan virtually disappears. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it does. I mean, there's instances of it. There's actually an instance in the South Seas. I forget which island it is, but there's talk of a Ku Klux Klan in one of the Pacific Islands. There's also very briefly a Klan in Kentucky, I think it is, but they're very minor. What's more interesting than that is the way that the interpretation shifts. That's the really crucial part of it.
In what way? What do you mean?
Well, what happens is from being regarded as an enemy by the North, they do an extremely good propaganda job, or the former Klansmen do a very, very good propaganda job, and really have a very different view of Reconstruction pushed forward.
Well, this becomes the hand-in-hand process of reframing the whole Civil War as a lost cause and sort of romanticizing the whole struggle, which leads us into the 20th century. And there is, of course, the general tenor of the country is reunification. This takes decades, of course. And by the 1920s, it's in full swing. This is an interesting facet of this story because the Klan as we know it that matures is really a 20th century phenomenon more than a 19th century phenomenon. It has everything to do with a book called The Klansman, which was released in the early 1900s, which is eventually made into the very famous film Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith. It's an incredibly amazing rebirth that we're talking about that has everything to do with media. Crazy, huh?
Yes. I mean, the Klan in the 1920s is very much a modern institution in some ways. It is the result of modern marketing and definitely modern media. The Birth of a Nation is really, if you could imagine, in terms of the impact that it had on the audiences, it's a cross between Saving Private Ryan and Star Wars. It's an extraordinary film.
Famous for many reasons. First of all, it's, you know, modern cinema is born in this movie. Close-ups and all sorts of things that had never been done. Action shots. I mean, it's quite an engaging three-hour film. It's really a blockbuster. And it becomes even more so because it is shown in the White House. The writer of The Klansman was a friend of Woodrow Wilson. So by the time Wilson comes into power, he has his own agenda as far as race in America. He ends up segregating Washington, D.C., the military, and so forth. He chooses to show, like any of these presidents do, you know, a big piece of culture that's going on out there in the White House. So Birth of a Nation very famously is shown in the White House, giving it an even more legitimate shine.
Yes, Woodrow Wilson is not just famous for having commented to Thomas Dixon, who was sitting next to him at the time. Yeah, this is history written with lightning, paraphrase, but something like the pity of it is the fact that it's so true. But the really interesting part of that is that D.W. Griffiths also used Wilson. In the storyboard flashes, you have quotations taken from Wilson. So Wilson is not just being used to advertise it, but he's actually being used to legitimate what's actually being said. You know, I mean, you imagine it would be extraordinary to have the president. Well, I mean, I know Trump appeared in Home Alone 2, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
But I think other than that, you know, to have the president endorsing a film in this way is extraordinary.
It leads to a revival, in more ways than one, of the KKK in Georgia around Atlanta. This is against the backdrop of a whole new set of cultural factors that these people are protesting and moving against, which is to say there's been an enormous amount of immigration throughout the 19th century. Now we have a new violation of American mores as far as they're concerned. All these Jews and Catholics from southern Italy, it's a whole new cause that they need to fight against, obviously in tandem with their former cause, which is against black people. This is an attraction for many people in America because all of this stuff is sweeping north and south.
Yes. The interesting thing about it is that the immigration issue is very much racialized in the 1920s. The Jews and the Catholics, largely from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, are portrayed as being different races, not just different nationalities, but different races. And particularly in the case of Jews, the religion is portrayed as a race. So in many ways, it's just including things rather than changing things. It's shifting the emphasis rather than truly changing it. But having said that, I think if you were to stop anyone on the street in 1920 and say to them, you know, what do you consider the greatest threats to America? They would probably say renewed immigration because it stopped because of the war. But renewed immigration would be certainly one of the major highlights of that. And the Klan deliberately target issues that they know will have mass appeal.
It's very much in the pocket of what's happening these days. I mean, there's similarities without the KKK part of the news being used to promote a certain agenda, a kind of almost propaganda quality to these siloed views of life. The KKK positions themselves squarely in the midst of that. By 1925, their membership has soared. I was shocked by this when I saw the number. 4 million members, roughly speaking. Some with very considerable political power, they are marching in the streets of Washington, D.C. in their costumes.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that that march in D.C., it looks incredibly impressive, and it impresses people that haven't been impressed by the Klan before. I mean, H.L. Mencken, he's the leading columnist of the era, writing for the Baltimore Sun, and he manages to promote the Klan accidentally by saying how impressive this march is. But the truth of the matter is that the Klan is already in decline by that point. By 1925, it's been rocked by major scandals. The march was meant to be 60,000 Klansmen. It's actually only 30,000 Klansmen, but they're very cleverly spaced out. They're very cleverly organized. Klan of the 1920s is brilliant at spectacle. You know, these marching parades that they have, rallies that they organize, 250,000, 300,000 people going to them. They're enormous events. I mean, I always think that one of the reasons why people joined the Klan in the 1920s was it was so boring in sort of, you know, the flyover states that we see nowadays. I mean, people had nothing to do. And to join the Klan and to pretend that you're a grand wizard or a goblin or something like that has always had an appeal, I think.
Talk about their tactics at this point, when they have reached the height of their power. Has it become more of a political organization, more than a paramilitary one?
Well, there's been a palace coup, really, in the 1920s. The founder of the rejuvenated Klan, William Joseph Simmons, has been ousted by a dentist from Texas, Hiram Wesley Evans, and he has much more political ambition. Simmons is always portrayed as being slightly airy-fairy, slightly sort of, you know, dreamy, and he was interested in creating what he called a classy order for classy people. He's not interested in anything other than that. The fact of the matter is that he probably was. He was very interested in the amount of money that it made for him, that's for sure. But Evans is a political animal, and he really shows this in the presidential primaries of 1924, where he ousts Al Smith, the Catholic governor of New York State. And he just pushes him to the sidelines. And that is really where he's showing his political muscle. But by 1925, that's beginning to ebb away. There's been too much scandal, too much dirt associated with the Klan.
You know, I came across an article which was fascinating in prepping for this about how Prohibition influenced this whole story. I mean, and so much in America at the time, but the Ku Klux Klan really used Prohibition to their advantage.
Yes, like most people that use Prohibition to their advantage, they were totally hypocritical about it. It plays to their advantage in the early 1920s. I mean, I think if we look at Prohibition, what's interesting about Prohibition is that it's very popular when it first starts. It loses its shine very, very quickly. And what we see with the Klan and Prohibition is that it utilizes that very cleverly. But by the time the shine is wearing off in the mid-1920s, it's being held against them. It's yet another target that people can say, you know, look at this organization, it's hypocritical, it's corrupt.
So for all the reasons of scandal and exposés, financial improprieties, this phase, phase two, really ends around the Great Depression. I mean, really, that puts the kibosh on so much in America.
Yes, I mean, it's been in steep decline. It's about 300,000 members. Estimating Klan numbers is a very, very difficult game indeed. You know, they big them up, their opponents knock them down. There's the difficulty that it's a secret organization. And we've never found that holy grail of the documentation that must have been destroyed in its Atlanta headquarters in the 1920s. But yes, it dies out.
But once again, come the 1950s, the rise of the civil rights movement in America, the Klan has a new role to play, which is to push against this kind of sweeping. I mean, talk about the amendments of the 1870s. This is now deliberately the federal government stepping in, desegregating, protecting rights of voting in the South, et cetera, et cetera. The Klan now moves back into its paramilitary role. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, very violent. In a way, it's forced to be violent because the moderate opposition to desegregation in particular, the ground has been taken by the citizens' organizations. And these citizens' councils have forced those people that aren't members of that but object to desegregation, they've forced them to become ever more violent, and they do become extraordinarily violent.
I mean, this is the bombing in Birmingham. This is the killings of the civil rights workers, Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, Michael Schwerner. All of that is Klan activity. The horrible scenes from those trials where they're laughing at the white jury who's going to let them go. All of that period of American history, you know, is what I grew up with, that I relate to the Klan. little did I know as a youngster in that generation that there was such roots going all the way back, you know, and that it was different iterations of that plant that we're talking about. That's what's so fascinating about the first, second, and third phase of this, and it's really interesting to talk about in those terms. Ever since, and fortunately so, there has been a decline. I think so much of this is because modern life, you know, intrudes these costumes. It's just as embarrassing to a lot of people. I mean, everybody rolls their eyes, including, you know, the alt-right people who are seeing the world in a different way and the media and so forth. How does the Klan react to that? Are there still people who are dressing up in these costumes and joining each other at revivals, or is that gone?
It still exists, but many people regard it as pretty idiotic. We see when David Duke takes over and rejuvenates the Klan very briefly in the 1970s, he alters the way that the Klan appears. He's no longer the imperial wizard of the Klan. He's the national director of the Klan. The Klan costume is only worn for ceremony. He realizes that that image is gone, but it's still very, very important, I would argue.
Your preface of the book, which is really a very, very good read, mentions the fact that there has never been a full volume written about the full history of the Ku Klux Klan. That was very surprising to me. But I think that's really an indicative of the sentiment I was talking about, that most people, you know, well, I guess they accomplished what they set out to do, which was they rise up in reaction to threats and then they go away and they sort of sleep in the culture. And then suddenly there's another thing. And that's proven out by their history. It has resisted the telling of the whole thing until now.
Yes, I mean, in 10 years' time, someone will be able to say, well, there hasn't been a history that goes up to the present day. But having said that, I mean, I think it's very important to take it to the point of the last real major history that was written of the Klan was 2015, I think. And of course, you know, 2016 changes things completely. It is one of those things that just emerges and there's peaks and there's troughs. It responds to the society around it. It grows and it shrinks according to that.
So much of this story, the legacy of the Klan is about this mythology, that this incredibly terrifying, the iconography, as I mentioned, the burning crosses, all these images. But it's really this myth that they're driving forward, that when we're necessary, we will return. That's so much of the story of the Klan, isn't it?
Yeah. One of the things that I've always found quite interesting about the Klan is that we could almost in many ways compare it to the Mafia. The Mafia's power is very rarely what it's made out to be. Just the same as the Klan is. And that's where the real danger lies with the Klan. That as long as we continue to treat the Klan as one organization, as long as we continue to give it the oxygen of publicity, as Margaret Thatcher would put it, as long as we do that, we run a greater risk of it returning, I think.
Christopher Alafat is an associate professor of U.S. history at the University of Exeter in England, author of The Ku Klux Klan and American History, first published in 2023. I invite people to listen. Very accessible history, very interesting and very applicable to our current times. Nice to meet you, Christopher. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of American History Hit. Please follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you'll also get your first 3 months for just $1 a month when you use code AmericanHistory at checkout.